On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
Now, question. Were you there in 2018 when the Rolling Stones played their final Irish performance in Croke Park? Because it's already the stuff of legend, and it was at least before the recent passing of Charlie Watts. There were tens of thousands of us at that one, but there were a few people who can lay claim to having seen them in Ireland before, because the Stones toured Ireland twice in 1965. They played Belfast, Dublin and Cork. They were still in their ascendancy and the fans in some cases got a little bit too excited. There was an RUC intervention in Belfast and there was a full-on riot in Dublin, and it's all captured in a brilliant documentary. It's called Charlie Is My Darling, probably named after the drummer, which has been perused in extremis by Donal Fallon, who is here to have a look at it. Donal, you and I, we were both, as it happens, in Croke Park in 2018 on a nearly full night, and it was a special enough gig in its own right.
It was an incredible gig, and I imagine it's a full Croke Park now in the retelling of the story, you know,
yes,
after the passing
yeah.
of Charlie Watts. I've never been to a concert that was quite like the Rolling Stones in Croker. It was enormous in scale. Mick Jagger still had it. He still had the moves. Mm-hmm. And who could forget him coming out, D.Eva Corgia,
yeah,
and telling the crowd he'd enjoyed a spice pack on a night out in Dublin.
Which he did. Better Irish enunciation than the Queen did, actually.
Yes, he did. He did. And I did not see that nod to the spice bag coming. But we got exactly what we went for. You know, we got exactly what we went for, which was all the hits. They were plentiful. And they were delivered by a band that still had tremendous enthusiasm for what they were doing, including Charlie, though he didn't like to show it. But the reviews were really, really kind. Alan Carr from the Irish Times said that Start Me Up, Jumping Jack Flash and Brown Sugar sound bright and fresh and the best is kept for the encore, with Gimme Shelter still impressive after all these listens and years. Well, the simple pleasure of Satisfactions, I love this, pent-up sexual frustration leaves a decidedly older, decidedly bohemian audience nodding sagely. That's some review of the crowd.
I didn't know he'd describe me as that, and now I'm a little bit put out.
That's a great review of the crowd, never mind the music.
Oh, no.
But you know, Charlie Watts, he may not have looked as enthusiastic in terms of what he was doing as Mick Jagger, but that in itself was part of his appeal. That was his style, if you will. Effortlessly cool, laid back, slick. And I think the passing of Charlie Watts, it's led to an enormous outpouring of praise from drummers, not only in the field of rock and roll, but other genres of music that greatly influenced his own style and his approach to music.
Yeah, I have to say, I wasn't a huge Stones fan, but I went along because everyone has that whole thing of, you know, wanting to see them before they stop touring forever, before one of them shuffles off. But actually, as I was saying off air just before you came in, my abiding memory of that is how Charlie Watts basically didn't break a sweat for the whole night. Now, it wasn't as if he was reserved or wasn't doing the job, but that the guy, just after years and years of doing this, could do 3 hours on a stage wearing a dress shirt and chinos and not once wear a sweat, skin like porcelain. It was so impressive that he still had the physical stamina to go through it all. We're going to talk though about the earlier visit, 1965, and this happens in maybe the most important year of the band's history, because it's the year that they really, really hit their stardom.
Oh yeah, I mean, 1965, the band begin 1965 as, you know, stars, as a big band, and they ended as global superstars. And the Rolling Stones in that year, they caused real joy and a few other emotions in Irish teenagers' lives. And they come here twice, which is incredible. You know, they do Dublin, Cork and Belfast on the first tour, and just Belfast, Dublin on the second. And thanks to the film Charlie Is My Darling, directed by Peter Whitehead, we know exactly what it was all like. Whitehead was kind of the director of the swinging 60s. He previously made a film about Allen Ginsberg, the beat poet.
Okay.
And then he was tasked with capturing the band of the decade, as many people felt they were, the band who are finally going to dethrone, if you will, dethrone the Beatles. And by accident, he kind of captures this brilliant snapshot of Irish youth culture, you know, at a moment in time.
So you mentioned the attempt to dethrone the Beatles, if you like, and this really was the defining thing that, you know, 30 years before Blur versus Oasis, this was like the great debate that every teenage group was having. It was over which of those two young British bands you liked, and parents often had their views on which one was more appropriate.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, you know, every great tale, of course, requires a rivalry in whatever part of life, you know, it may be. Oasis, Blur, Mick O'Heffo, we could go on and on and on, whether real or invented.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the world of 1965, the rivalry was Beatles versus Stones. And I think what the Beatles had was they had kind of intergenerational appeal. They were kind of clean cut. They were friendly. Mm. Teenagers loved them, and their mums loved them, and their grandparents might even love them. But when it came to the Rolling Stones, we can take this from one Irish newspaper. Girls, think of five way out characters with long hair and crazy music that your mothers wouldn't like to see you out with. And who comes to mind? Their motto is convention go hang, roll over Beethoven. Yes, it's the Rolling Stones. And that isn't NME or Melody Maker. That's the Leinster Times in January 1965. So there's a fear, you know, there's a real fear, the essence of how young girls and their mothers, you know, felt about the Rolling Stones.
The Leinster Times is the title I've never come across before, but I like that if you presumed there was a Leinster Times in 2021, it would be like a local paper in Kildare or Carlow, and I love the idea that people would be getting their pop culture knowledge from that. In January, when they do come to Ireland, like, they're putting in a shift because they manage in 3 days to play six shows.
Yeah, and the plan reads like the plan of a band who are suddenly making a lot of cash and want to capitalise on it. So two shows in Belfast, train down to Dublin, two shows in Dublin the next day, drive down to Cork, two shows in Cork, six shows in 3 days. Wow. That had already been in Belfast the previous year, but there's something very different about 65, and the press reports are great. 6th of January, the Rolling Stones played to 3,000 screaming kids in the Belfast cinema over the heads of a cordon of RUC men who formed across the front of the stage to prevent the young audience coming too near its idols. And one of the people who's also on stage that night is Phil Coulter, actually. He's up with the support act, and he recounts...
Sorry, I shouldn't laugh, because like, that isn't. Like, it just seems so incongruous, though.
Phil's in the support band, and he recounts, back in Belfast for the first time since leaving Queens, I got a kick out of looking out from the stage of the cinema and seeing a squad of RUC officers forming a barricade to hold back the screaming teenagers. Mm. It's so innocent when you think that the North is, like, you know, just a couple of short years away from erupting into total chaos. The best thing RUC men could do in January 1965 was protect the Rolling Stones from the teenagers from the Falls and Shank Hill.
It's a shame that their projects and their work assignments weren't always quite so benign. The press weren't always kind, and some of them were maybe more interested in the crowd that the RUC were trying to keep away than the band itself. And there's one journalistic report which finds the band to be completely underwhelming.
Yeah, after Belfast they come to Dublin, and the Irish Times says the reception for them by the teenagers was deafening. The aisles were jammed, and those at the back had to stand on their seats to see the stage. Cork, the Evening Echo in Cork is great. The report says, the Stones rolled in and rolled out, leaving not a ripple on the surface of Cork's normal life. Which is a great dismissive kind of Corkonian.
It sounds like somebody didn't get a ticket.
Bah humbug, exactly. But when the band come back then, in September of that year, things are really different. I mean, they're now arguably the second biggest band in the world. By September, I Can't Get No Satisfaction is a massive US hit. And it's a weird one, actually, because it's a hit in America before it's a hit in Britain and Ireland. But it's about to become number one in Ireland and stay there for a month. And this time they have Peter Whitehead with them, and he's tasked with capturing that second tour. And the footage is absolutely incredible in terms of seeing a band at the height of their power. But the sound as well, it's the best they ever were.
He captures the gigs in the Adelphi. And of course, the Adelphi is also the one in which, you know, over the sands of time, you now have something like 14 million people who claim that they were in the Adelphi to see the Beatles in the same venue.
Yeah. We talked about the Adelphi recently on the slot, because that's also where Bob Dylan would play that first gig. So they do two gigs in the same day in Dublin, in the same venue that I kind of witnessed Beatlemania. But the thing about the Adelphi, it's a former cinema. It fits about 2,000 screaming kids. So you could have got six times as many people to a Rolling Stones gig in Dublin if you wanted to, but the venue wasn't there. And I think the fact that the venue is so condensed kind of adds to the madness, if you will, of the occasion. But when you watch that footage, John Savage has written about the film. The way he writes about it is great. He says, the concert is explosive. The group's whole purpose seems to be to create frenzy, and the crowd is barely contained throughout. In Dublin, they scream, yell, throw anything they can get their hands on, rush the stage, and assault the musicians, bringing the show to a rapid halt. A very strange way of showing affection, if you will, for the band on stage.
The funny thing about the footage, and I'll tweet a link actually to the footage in just a couple of minutes, but the funny thing about it is that it's years before the film ever sees the light of day. In fact, even though this is shot in 1965, it was only ever fully released 9 years ago.
Which is weird, for all kinds of various reasons, primarily kind of bureaucratic reasons. They released the thing in 2012, Charlie Is My Darling, and the name is derived from a traditional Scottish folk song connected to the great Robbie Burns. Okay. But I think Whitehead got on particularly well with the dashing Mr. Watts, so that might explain the title, the nod in his direction. And he interviews the band throughout with the gig footage, really frank interviews about various things. Maybe it was just as well this didn't come out at the time. Brian Jones says, let's face it, my future as a Rolling Stone is very uncertain. My ultimate aim in life was never to be a pop star. I enjoy it with reservations, but I'm not really satisfied artistically or personally. So there's real tensions in the band. That, you know, probably better off kept on the shelf until 2012.
The idea that, like, he wasn't satisfied artistically, whatever, but personally, if suddenly fame isn't all you're cut out to be. But if you're in a band like that and you're getting famous for stuff that you don't find fulfilling, maybe there is a kind of a latent tension there. We said this is an important moment in the band's history, but I mean, there are other ways in which Dublin manages to retain its own part in the Rolling Stone story.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at these two tours, it's kind of funny to me that they played Cork in the first tour and not the second. So maybe they read the Cork press and that very disappointed review. the echo.
It's like Nirvana never had that problem.
Yeah. Absolutely, but they retained a great affection for Ireland in the broadest sense. Those gigs, I should say, plural, they are the stuff of legend, not only in terms of Irish live music, but the folklore of the band. I mean, I think it marked a new chapter. The same thing happened soon afterwards in Berlin and other cities on the continent. But this was kind of the arrival, if you will, of a Stones mania that could match Beatlemania. And the Rolling Stones, they came back here quite a lot. They duetted with the Chieftains on a version of the Rocky Road to Dublin, which is incredible. Great guitar solo on it. Unlike anything you'll hear on any other traditional Irish music record, it goes without saying. And they also recorded one of their own albums at the famous Windmill Lane recording studio. But look, when they were here to play Croker in 2018, people were asking them about the 1965 gig and how much of that tour they remembered in the haze of rock and roll.
When you're playing six gigs in 3 days, you probably won't remember very many.
You remember a whole lot of it. How much of the gigs they remembered, I don't know, but nobody who was in the Adelphi that day will ever forget the energy of those 1965 gigs.
And no doubt in future generations, there'll be plenty of people who'll say they were there in Croke Park. There'll be hundreds of thousands of people who'll say they saw their final Irish performance. Donal Fallon, thank you very much as ever. Donal Fallon, historian, author of Henrietta Street from Tenement to Suburbia and presenter of the Three Castles Burning podcast on Dublin history, which you'll find wherever you get your podcasts online.
On the Record with Gavin Riley.
On News Talk